Welcome to Open Air with Sherry Huber. Just a short note to let you know that we had technical difficulty with this week's show, so the recording ends abruptly.
Good evening and welcome to Good News Updates from Living Compassion. I'm excited to be joined tonight by Deb from Los Angeles. Welcome, Deb.
Hi, Michael.
Great to have you here.
Good to be here.
I'm also excited to have Dave here. Dave is a monk at the Zen Monastery Peace Center. Welcome, Dave.
Hey, Michael.
Great to have you here.
Yeah, great to be here as always.
Oh, good. Deb, I understand that you are a sitting group coordinator in the big city of Los Angeles.
Yes, in the big city of Los Angeles.
Great. Could you tell us a little bit about what that's like?
Sure, yeah. So we have a sitting group here that meets twice a week. We meet on Sunday evenings and Tuesday evenings. And it's a really incredible experience. I don't know how I could be living in this city without the support of this group.
Uh-huh.
So we get together and we meditate together for half an hour, and then we have group discussion for half an hour, just like we do it at the monastery.
Wow. Great. So people come together, they meditate for half an hour, and then they have a group discussion for half an hour.
Yeah, and it's really neat because it's pretty much an experience of the privileged environment like we have at the monastery, where people can come and just have their experience, be in a place where they can just be present to what's going on with them and get some coaching, some facilitation with that, and also really learn from other people sharing their experience of practice.
Yeah. So they come to the sitting group, meditate, they can be facilitated within the group discussion, and it all takes place within that privileged environment.
Yeah, which I think is a pretty unique thing. So it's fun because there are some people who come who have been sitting for a really long time and who have spent time at the monastery and all of that. And then there are other people who come who are new to meditation. And it's just perfect because it's a space where people can really get, they can really come and have an experience of compassionate awareness. And if they're new to practice then and they're not able to, let's say, get away and go on retreat, then this is just a way that they can begin doing the practice, begin incorporating it in their lives, you know?
So you have people there who sounds like are very experienced and perhaps have spent some time at the monastery, and also people who are completely new to practice and perhaps even to meditation.
Yeah. And it's just really fun.
Great. You know, that's my experience as well at the Zen Center here in Palo Alto.
Yeah, you've got a sitting group there too.
Yes. Deb, when I go to the monastery, I feel like I'm in a place with a lot of experienced people kind of guiding me and setting up the privileged environment and supporting me in that. Is that what you're doing, sort of setting up the privileged environment and providing a kind of a model for what we're going for?
Yeah, that's exactly it. And what's neat about it is, for me, because I got to spend a lot of time at the monastery, for me, it's just been really neat and affirming to see how we can take that model anywhere we go. Take it into a big city and start a sitting group, and people really get the experience of compassionate awareness. They really get the experience that we try to create for people on retreats, just on a much smaller scale in a sitting group. So it's really powerful. It seems like it impacts everyone, and I know it really impacts me. So.
Yes. So getting a flavor of that retreat experience in a kind of a shorter time period.
Yeah.
And as you said, you've spent a lot of time at the monastery, and so you bring that experience of the privileged environment and what that looks like.
Yeah. I'm very lucky for that.
Great.
Yeah.
Great. Could you take maybe just a minute and talk about, sort of in brief, what that privileged environment is?
Sure, yeah. Well, it's a space where, you know, both of the places where the sitting group meets are yoga studios. And so other classes that are taught there, people will often show up and socialize beforehand and, you know, kind of chit-chat and all of this. But with the meditation group, we just meet beforehand and you just get to come and be in silence. And for a lot of people, that's just the first time in their day or the only time in their week, really, that they get to come and actually just be silent somewhere and
yeah.
and just have, be with their experience and not have to put on sort of their social facade or even just put on a smile if they don't feel like it. They don't have to be a somebody.
Yeah.
They can just come and be however they are.
That's
so,
great.
Yeah, so that's really powerful. And then, you know, within the group, there's certain guidelines that we follow. So people maintain the privileged environment by, again, not socializing and really respecting each other's experience by not sort of in the conversation offering advice to each other or butting in on people's sharing their experience, this kind of thing. Keeping custody of the eyes. So people have a place where they can basically be supported in learning how to focus their attention and not have all the distraction that they're used to living with in the city.
Yeah.
So typically in the city environment, you know, there's cell phones going off and there's billboards and people can talk to them left and right. And this is just
yeah.
a space where the whole time we're there, they have a support in focusing their attention within.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Deb, the next time in L.A., I'm going to be there.
Hope to see you, Michael.
Yeah. Thanks for joining us tonight.
Sure. Thanks.
Dave, I was wondering, you're at the monastery, and you're overseeing these sitting groups. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Great. Can you tell us a little bit about what you see from your perspective on that?
Well, from the monastery's perspective, you know, the work that Deb's doing is really important and valuable in sort of providing access to the practice for people and also support for people as they're practicing in the world. You know, we have a lot of people come through the monastery to do retreats and workshops. And, you know, if their only access to support were at the monastery, it'd be kind of a rough go for people. But we have a lot of things, a lot of ways of support that we have set up. And one of the biggest ones, at least from my point of view, is the sitting groups. And so, like, you know, somebody in L.A. Can go to Deb's group once a week and can be with people who are attempting to do the same thing, you know, who are attempting to wake up and end suffering in the way that we practice.
Yeah.
And it's kind of, you know, a shot in the arm every week. And there's an opportunity to hear sort of what's going on with, you know, other people who are doing the same thing in the same area. And so it's, you know, it's, and then, of course, Deb's group is not the only group. We have a number of them scattered out throughout the country, and it's like having a sort of a network for people, places people can go to experience the privileged environment Deb was talking about and really get support for the you know, a lot of times real deep inner work that they're doing.
Yes, yes. That's the sense I get of being at the monastery, being supported directly in that way, and also being here in Palo Alto and being supported coming to the sitting group here. So if I'm out in the world and excited about sitting, is it possible for me to start a sitting group?
Well, it is possible. I don't know if you could tell, I know you could, Michael, but for folks listening, people could tell, you know, how much attention goes into how these groups are structured and run.
Yeah.
Because like Deb was saying, you know, it's important that it happen in this privileged environment. You know, it's important that people have a place to go to where they don't have to be a personality, you know, where they don't have to worry about, you know, kind of the difficult things that happen between conditioned people that
yes.
are normally happening out in the world. People need to have a place to go to where that's not going to go on, and they can just relax and turn their attention inward and see what's going on.
Yes.
And it takes a lot of experience to be able to coordinate something like that. It takes a lot of experience with the practice. And
yes.
so, you know, of course, what Deb's done, Deb spent a lot of time at the monastery, has done, been doing practices for years, and so she's in a really good place to be able to offer that. And so it's something that we ask for from all of the people who coordinate our sitting groups is that they just have a really deep practice themselves and have spent a lot of time with us and have done a lot of practice with us.
Uh-huh. So have a lot of experience with practice, having spent a lot of time with you at the monastery or on retreat.
Yeah, because, you know, that environment that Deb's talking about is so different from the way things normally are.
Yes.
In the world, you know, to have that kind of environment where we're not being social, where awareness is what's prioritized rather than conditioned mind and all the ways people act out of conditioned mind.
Yes.
It takes a lot of experience working with conditioned mind and seeing how conditioned mind works to be able to, you know, to kind of uphold a space like that for people.
Yes. Yes. That's my experience as well, is that getting familiar with how conditioning operates within me is really critical to, you know, being centered myself. And then, you know, a giant step beyond that, which is representing practice as a, for example, as a sitting group coordinator.
Yeah, and it is a giant step, isn't it?
Yes.
It's something people step into, I think. You know, people get involved with practice, they get excited, they're doing their own practice to whatever degree they can, they're participating in workshops and retreats, you know, they're going to sitting groups if there's one available, they're doing the reading the books and doing the email classes and all the different things that are offered. And there's a kind of a maturity in practice that grows as people do that. And then at some point, some people find that they want to take that next step and they want to be able to offer practice to other people who have the same excitement that they do. And it's kind of, they step into that, and then that work becomes something that supports their practice and helps their own practice to grow, kind of in the way Deb was talking about.
Yes, yes, yes. Tell me if this is what you're saying, that, for example, as a sitting group coordinator, it's work to support my own practice, for example, if I'm a sitting group coordinator.
Absolutely, yeah, that's the reason that we do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, we don't technically do it for the other people. We do everything that we do in practice for ourselves in a way and for our own practice.
Yes.
And so, you know, if I'm establishing a sitting group, I know I'm going to have to show up. You know, if it's happening every Monday night, I know I'm going to have to be there. And that supports me. And then, of course, being required to put myself in the place of someone who is really representing the practice, that supports me also, because that requires me to go to a place inside myself which is, you know, as big as I can find.
Yes, yes. Very exciting.
Good. It's a good thing.
It is a good thing. Dave, thanks for joining us again tonight.
Thanks a lot, Michael.
You're welcome. Good evening and welcome to Open Air with Sherry Huber. Good evening, Sherry.
Good evening.
Good evening, Sherry.
How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Excellent.
Wonderful.
Having a marvelous time, as you know.
As I do. I do indeed.
We've been in beautiful Carmel for a few days now, having our Living Compassion board retreat.
Yes.
And as, again, you very well know, it's a working retreat for us. So we're working on Living Compassion and Zen Center things, but we're also painting the House of Prayer for the sisters.
Yes.
So we get to do all kinds of working meditation and sitting and enjoying the beach and like that.
Yes. And I didn't have a chance to mention it while I was there. And I, though part of me was very resistant to the working meditation, it's very peaceful.
Oh, working meditation is the best.
Yes.
I always kind of marvel and feel sad that people don't enjoy working meditation because it's the most like real life of anything that we do.
Yes.
Which is why it is the kind of retreat that we do. You know, instead of, yes, we do workshops and all kinds of things where people just sort of leave home and they come somewhere and it tends to be we'll do our best to create that privileged environment that people have been talking about.
Yes.
But it's difficult. It's a one day away from our regular life is not very much break from everyday life.
Yes.
So, of course, we do longer retreats, and we do working meditation. There's an old somebody asked a Zen master once, why do you sit? And he said, well, sit because we can't stand up all the time. And And, you know, and then went through that whole sequence of, and then we can't always sit, so we sleep. And we can't always sleep, so we work. But we can't always work, so we walk.
Right.
And that's the rhythm of life and the rhythm of mindfulness practice.
Yes.
So to be able to do working meditation, to practice being conscious and present while doing a task is just the greatest of all possible gifts, because most people are conditioned to have this belief that there's spirituality or there's meditation or there's awareness practice or there, whatever that is, and it's very separate from real life. So you go do that, and then you get on with your life. But to be able to have your whole life be awareness practice so that every moment truly is an opportunity to end suffering, because it's a moment that we are present for. If I do my spirituality over here and then I train myself, what I practice is going unconscious in order to go out and interact with my family and friends and go to work and interact with my coworkers and go to the grocery store and do all of the things that I do in regular life. If those are all unconscious activities, my chances of ending suffering drop pretty somewhere down below nil.
Yes.
But if I can practice awareness all the time, then my odds of ending suffering are very, very, very good.
Yes. Yes.
The working meditation, it's a good thing.
It's a good thing. Yes, that's my experience. And another good thing, Sherry, is that we have some callers lined up here.
Oh, excellent.
In fact, quite a few of them.
Oh, very good.
Great. You ready to talk?
It's a call-in radio show.
Yes.
It's good to have callers.
Yes. Okay, our next caller, our first caller, you are on the air, and could you please introduce yourself?
Hi, this is Julianne.
Hey, Julianne.
Hello, how are you?
I'm well, and yourself?
I'm great, thanks.
And what's going on in your world?
Well, I'm so excited to call in, as I always am. It's so great to talk to you. But I was calling in for a couple reasons. First, I guess, just for support. And
which is a good thing, isn't it?
Yes.
Good to when we lay out our day or our week or our month or whatever, it's good to plug in the supports.
Absolutely.
Uh huh.
Yeah, it is, and I am so grateful for all of the means of support that you do provide, because they really, really help.
Good. Good.
Yeah. So, thank you. I'm so excited because so many things are starting to sink in that it's like all the pieces of the puzzle are kind of starting to come into place together.
Isn't that a wonderful experience?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, we have that experience regularly.
Mm-hmm.
We just don't expect to have it with something like awareness practice. Right.
Right.
Can you imagine? Can you remember being in math classes or language classes, and it's just and then all of a sudden it starts dropping into place.
Yeah.
And what was just this massive, unrelated stuff
mm-hmm.
suddenly is becoming cohesive.
Yeah, it's true. It's so funny how you can get. It's funny, though, because I didn't even think that I was overwhelmed at first.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I thought I got it right away.
Uh-huh.
And but yet there were, well, I mean, I guess that's true and not true. There were parts that I didn't get. And then there were parts that were really, you know, resonating with me.
Yes, it is true. And it's true on that, in that way, that I always get what I get. And usually have no clue about what I don't get.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we're in a workshop or something and somebody says something and you think, now that means something to that person, but I have no idea what they're talking about. My
husband
used to say, you know, people would say to him, I understand every word you're saying and I have no idea what you're talking about. So there's that one, and there's also the one of, oh, yeah, I get that. And then a couple of years into practice, you go, oh, my gosh. Oh, I see what that is. And then 5 more years go by, and you have an understanding of it that's so much broader and so much deeper. But it doesn't mean you didn't understand it the first time.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that it gets deeper and broader the longer we practice.
Yeah. And it's like a structure that's being reinforced. It always existed, but more supports are becoming are being revealed.
Yes, and we could almost use an image if it's our spiritual well-being that it for most of us when we start it's a pretty dilapidated structure.
Yeah.
It hasn't
completely
had a lot of attention for a long time. And
yeah.
Here we are. You know, we're reinforcing, put a little cross brace on there and a little this and a little that, and it's getting more stable. And pretty soon you look at it and you think, that's getting downright attractive.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Well, it's, I think what, one of the things, there were, I think when I started, there were two experiences that were already experiences that I'd had of being at center. And that was doing my art, which has kind of been this thing that I've been reporting back about not doing.
reporting on the absence of.
The absence of my art. But when I do art, I am at center, and it's wonderful. And then, and when I was little, I think I was like 5 or 6, I was always kind of questioning, and I've always been like questioning everything and wondering about things. And when I was little, I would do this trick. I would ask myself, who am I, over and over and over again until I would make myself disappear. And because I really just questioned this, what the heck is Julianne? You know, I know everyone thinks that they know what I am, and I would literally make myself disappear, and it was kind of like a thrill to me at that time. But then it was very scary because I thought maybe I wouldn't come back, and I would do it over and over again. And I think at the time my ego was probably really, you know, the one that was scared about it.
Yes. Nervous that it was going to permanently lose its grip.
Yeah. Because, you know, that's a time when you're probably, your ego development is pretty important, I guess. I don't know, maybe not. But
well,
but anyway.
Pretty much what's going on.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. So then when I started practice, meditation became that third experience of center. And I realized with you know, I haven't been doing art, and I have this fear of it, and obviously it's ego's fear because it's one of those times when I really, you know, reach that place.
And isn't it good to see that?
Yeah.
Because before you saw that, before you realized that, it was such fertile ground for beatings.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
So art is so important to you. Why don't you do it? What's the matter with you? Why don't you just make a commitment and stick to it? Why can't you? And then to get to that point in your practice where you realize, wow, that whole thing is just a setup, because the very voices that are beating me up for not doing it are setting me up not to do it because there are so many beatings involved. And the reason I meant not to do it is that when I do it, I go to center.
Right.
That's so huge.
I know, and it was weird because the last time that I called, I practice. I mean, it's so important. I mean, it's my, you know, it's everything. And that is all that I really wanted to do, you know, and I was okay with that. I was okay with just, I'm not doing my art right now. It doesn't matter. And I'm grateful for the understanding that has been reached, because now I guess I've come to a greater understanding of how that process works and how my subpersonalities are playing into it.
And how art can be your practice.
Exactly. It's
not that it's going to take the place of sitting.
No. Yeah, yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Right. So I took that attitude. I've been able to come to this new relationship with the voices of where it's like I don't hate them. They're there. They're really strong. But I know that what they are, and I know that when I do my art, they're going to be there. But I don't have to listen to them, because when I'm doing my art, I am tapping into that oneness, and that is all that I need to trust. You know, I just trust that experience. I've had it, and I just let it be. And so I've been doing these portraits, these self-portraits, using the pictures that I gathered together when I first started practicing. It's something that one of the books that you have, you recommended perhaps getting out a couple of photos to help yourself love yourself better. When I'm looking at myself as a little girl, it makes it easier. And so I have kind of like this group of photos that lead me up through, you know, to 25, 30 years. And I've been doing, you know, each one a little bit older, and it's so neat. It's so fun. It's just like a tribute to this whole process. And they've been turning out great, so it's really cool.
That is marvelous.
Yeah.
There's an old Zen story that, I don't know if you've ever run across it, but you would definitely relate to.
Mm-hmm.
The guy, art is a big part of the history of Zen. In Japan, all kinds of things were ways of practicing awareness. So Ikebana, the flower arranging and
mm-hmm.
sword fighting, and calligraphy is a huge one.
Mm-hmm.
And so this guy is practicing his calligraphy, and he makes the, you know, he does the movement, and watching him go, no. And he does it again. This goes on forever. And finally the guy who's monitoring this, I don't know if he's what he is, but probably in our language, the voice of self-hate, he has to go to the bathroom. And so he leaves the room, and the guy thinks, okay, this is it. I'm alone finally for just a minute. And he makes the mark. He draws the whatever it is, and the guy comes back and says. So I've always loved that as an example of when we are being guided and driven by those voices, the self-consciousness that we suffer with kind of paralyzes us. As long as we're in that relationship
mm-hmm.
with the voices that leaves us we're looking to them
mm-hmm.
for guidance and direction. We believe what they're saying. We care about their opinion.
Right.
We're trying to please them, which is one of the most misguided things that we can do.
Mm-hmm.
Then we're just rendered incapable of doing anything authentic.
Yeah.
But when that relationship changes and our attention is no longer on those voices, then authenticity is ours. And we can act from that in an authentic, unselfconscious, original, beautiful sort of way.
Yeah.
But when someone sees it, the response will be, ah, yes, that's perfect.
Oh, that's so great. I know. It, because before I was definitely in relationship with those voices and doing or not doing because of those voices. And now when I sit down, I'm like, it doesn't matter what this looks like. It doesn't matter how I do it. I don't have to follow anybody's rules. I can just do this the way I want to do it.
Doing it for her.
Yeah.
Doing it for the moment. I'm doing it for life.
Yeah.
I'm doing it to be here, to be present.
Mm-hmm.
Ah, congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
I love happy. It might not be the ultimate happy ending, but it's
It is. It's a happy time.
Yeah, a happy time.
I don't know. Yeah, I'm happy.
Yeah. All right.
All right. Well, thank you.
Good
night.
Thanks for joining us, Julianne. You're listening to Open Air with Sherry Huber. Sherry, I'm showing at least four more callers here.
Right.
Okay. Our next caller, you are on the air, and could you please introduce yourself?
Hello?
Oh.
Oh, hi. Hey, Sherry, this is Tammy from Asheville, North Carolina.
Tammy?
Yeah.
How's it going in Asheville, North Carolina?
It's great. I'm so excited to talk to you. I'm so excited. This is great.
Good. What can we talk about?
Well, I was going to tell you, I saw you, you came here a couple years ago to a church.
Yes, I did.
A couple hours, yeah, and I came to that, and then I missed your retreat here, you know, a month ago or whenever, but anyway.
It was just there.
I know you were just here, and actually, I knew you were here, and I wasn't able to make it, but I'm just so excited to get to talk to you tonight.
Good.
So, I'm practicing, and I'm sitting, and I'm a little bit nervous because I've been sitting here listening to so many voices tell me that I have nothing to call in about, and this is ridiculous, and
don't
how embarrassing, and you know.
Don't you love them? They're just. So worthwhile, aren't they?
I know. And the other I mean, you know, it's why every week I somehow forget to call in, you know.
Right.
Anyway. So I'm working with something that I'm a little bit stuck with, and looking at it, and I feel like I need some help with this. And I think a little bit of content, would that be okay? Or?
Sure.
Okay. This is in relationship to a family member, a person in law in my family, and over the years, I have made contact and called and not received really many calls. There's always sort of an absence of any calling back or answering the phone or any contact like that unless we're in a family sort of situation. And so there's nieces and nephews involved, and there was a birthday, and I didn't hear back after I had sent a gift and called and sang happy birthday and all this kind of thing. And anyway, the point is I had I made a decision. I felt from a centered place that I would call her instead of thinking about this all the time and maybe talking to another family member, but sort of just talk to her about it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I did that, and I'm thinking the conversation didn't go that well.
Uh-huh. What?
Well, it didn't go that well because I didn't get a very good response about it. And in turn, my brother, a close family member, I think is very upset. And so I'm dealing with, I'm trying to, there have been some emails involved and that seemed a little impersonal. But I felt that I took some time after an email that was a little bit harsh. I felt to sit with it and not respond and react quickly. And, I think I'm trying to get down to sort of the core of what's happening with this in my practice, but you know, I'm feeling that I haven't been heard.
Uh-huh.
And I'm
feeling. And so can you tell me the kind of things that come back to you? Do people?
Well, yeah. I mean, what I'm hearing is I really screwed up
by calling, by making
by calling. Call. And uh-huh. And I have to say, you know, when I called, I'm pretty sure, I mean, I probably wasn't in the most loving voice. I was sort of trying to take care of myself in the call, and I was maybe responding to some defensiveness. So I didn't apologize for myself the whole time, which is something I've sort of always done, that the minute I wanted to express a feeling, I would take it back or apologize or worry about, you know, what the other person's thinking.
Which actually, from what you're describing, hadn't gotten you very far.
Hasn't gotten me far at all. In fact, it's what I realized in this process is that I've abandoned myself most of my life.
Uh-huh. Which is a good thing to realize.
Exactly. Yes, and I'm grateful for that. I mean, I think that was a big thing. But what I'm noticing is that I guess there's patterns set up we have in these relationships. And
oh, yes.
And because I didn't immediately apologize and take back what I said, you know, there's a backlash going on inside my head, and there's actually a backlash going on in my life with somebody that I love. And
okay.
I've acknowledged that I didn't intend for the conversation to go poorly, and I spoke from my truest place, and these are my feelings that, you know, blah, blah, blah. But I'm now at a point where this person won't call me back, won't respond. And I am not making sense of it. I'm just, you know, I'm watching my mind
okay.
May about
I?
It. Yeah,
May
please.
I?
Mm-hmm.
So what do you want from this relationship? Why have this relationship?
Well, because I guess one of the voices I'm hearing is that this is my brother, and I can't imagine not having a relationship with him.
You can't imagine not having a relationship with him. Why? Because he's your brother? Or because
that would mean, I guess that would mean something is really wrong with me, or
okay.
Something is wrong. Yeah.
Something is wrong because people should have relationships with their brother.
Yeah, like how would that be to go around? I mean, there's another part of me that's hearing that I don't want that sort of bad energy between him or, you know,
okay.
How do I go through my life like that?
Here's the thing that I have not heard you say. I love him.
And I do love him. I should have said that, but I do love him.
Okay.
And I...
But you can see how... I bet, especially if you listen back to this, that what was presented sounded very much like a should.
Right.
That I should have a relationship with my brother. There's something really wrong if I don't. It says something really negative if I don't. It's not okay not to. Okay. So that's one situation, and that would take us down one path.
Right.
But if it's I want a relationship with this person because I love him, then that takes us down a very different path.
Yeah.
There aren't the shoulds in that. That?
Yeah.
So then the action would be very different depending on which path we're going to take. So
well,
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I have focused, I mean, I should have said that, but I focused on the path of that I love. I mean, that has come out. I didn't say it, but I mean, that has been my deepest feelings, that I love him, and that's why I want to find some resolution, you know?
Yes. Now, those two things actually don't go together. Loving someone and having resolution. And I would suggest that one, loving someone comes from the heart. Having resolution comes from the head. Get a sense of that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because if I love you, then, and that's all that's going on. You know, you're my daughter, you're my sister, you're my whatever, and I love you. I don't actually need resolution about anything. I need to love you. I don't actually technically need anything from you. I don't even need you to love me. I don't need for you to be a certain way, to act a certain way, to say certain things. I don't need you to be in relationship with me in a particular way. I need to love you. With me?
Yeah, I am. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, I've been focused so on some action to take to, you know, make him talk to me or be heard and it was, you know, I've felt the whole time, but I love him so much, and
yes.
it
think in this conversation, you've been able to get a sense of which part of you has taken over. That the love has really been kind of pushed to the back burner by somebody who wants resolution. Who wants to be heard.
Yeah.
Who wants not to be perceived as she's been perceived in the past. Who wants...
Yeah.
Yeah. And so here's my encouragement. And now that you've called in once, you can become a regular, right? Because it's easy, isn't it? You just pick up the phone, you punch in those numbers, there you are. Okay? So here's what I'm going to ask you to do between now and when we check in the next time. I'm going to ask you to get to know that person who wants resolution. And not that there's anything wrong with her, because there isn't anything wrong with her. It's just that her desire for a particular action and outcome causes her to focus on that instead of you, instead of your brother. So often we find ourselves, it's easier to see in other people, obviously, but we can find ourselves stuck in a principle that would cause us to sacrifice folks. And we see it all the time, of course, in families, where somebody has, or friendships, where there's a principle that is involved. And the focus on that principle causes us to have to shut someone out of our lives. And so just to, number one, get to know her and then look deeply inside yourself, you know, all get to know all the parts of you who are involved in this and see if the decision is, if it would be preferable to give up the principal or give up the brother. So that's your homework assignment.
Yeah, I mean, may I say one thing?
Sure, absolutely.
Or do we have time? You know, I have. And I hear that, and I want to sit with that a little bit. I feel that I have. I mean, I haven't felt that I came from this. In terms of trying to make contact, I'm stuck as well, I guess, is that I've made contact and said, you know, I felt in a heartfelt letting go way of wanting to move on. I felt that I was letting go of any principle around this. But I think that the person who might be wanting the resolution is the person who really wants to be liked and not thought of in a certain way.
Yes, and... wants it on her terms.
And so you mentioned that we can be, I mean, we love someone and not be in relationship with them, which I can't obviously control right now what he wants to do.
Right.
And that, so in the way I see that is sort of losing my brother.
Well, it doesn't have to be. But that's the way conditioning would set it up.
Oh.
Because loving your brother doesn't have anything to do with what he's doing.
Oh, yeah.
It's a marvelous secret to catch on to. Because it's how we don't lose people through death.
Yeah, I've certainly guess I thought that to be in relationship and to be loved and loving, you're in contact. You know, you're
yes. And of course what I'm pointing you toward is being loving. Not worrying about being loved. We get out of life what we do. So when I am loving, I feel loved. When I'm not loving, I don't feel loved regardless of what anyone else is doing or not doing.
Okay.
Will you check back in?
I will. That thank you. This was really, really supportive, and I'm really grateful.
But I'm glad, and I'm eager to hear what you see as you look closer at this.
Okay.
Right. Take good care of yourself.
Thank you so much, Sherry. Thank you so much, and thank you, Michael. It's a real privilege to talk to you. So.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.
Good night.
Good night.
Thanks for joining us. You're listening to Open Air with Sherry Huber. Sherry, I have good news and bad news, and it's the same news. There are 5 people lined up to call here.
So should I talk faster, or just
are doing just absolutely fabulous, and that call was really inspiring to me. That was really great.
Yeah, and if we don't get to people, then hopefully they will be the first ones who call next week.
Yes, that's a great idea. Sherry, we're going to take a quick break here, and we'll be right back.
The Zen Blues Quartet is a collaborative music project celebrating life and the music of the blues. Good musicians and good friends coming together to make something really beautiful simply because we can. Zen Blues Music. For myself, as a Zen student, I see a direct connection between playing the blues and awareness practice, because for me, both seem to require a willingness to be really present in the moment. Zen Blues Quartet is proud to sponsor Open Air Talk Radio with Sherry Huber, as we firmly believe that the quality of your life is dependent on the focus of your attention.
What a life, what a life.
Visit us at www.zenbluesmusic.com for more information about our project.
Welcome back to Open Air with Sherry Huber. Sherry, we have our next caller.
All right.
Next caller, you are on the air, and could you please introduce yourself?
Hi, Sherry. This is Janice from Dallas.
Hello.
Hello. Can you hear me?
I can.
Okay. I've never called in before. I've always listened to archives, and I've never really listened in on a live show or called in.
Well, congratulations for doing everything that was necessary to get you here in this moment. We appreciate it.
Thanks. And that actually has something to do with what I'm calling in about, too. It seems really big, though, okay?
Uh-huh.
And you could label it procrastination, but
I'm not going to.
it's a process, but you could put any content into it, like calling into your show.
Uh-huh.
So the process basically goes, I really, really want to do something, not just kind of a good idea, but I really want to do something, and then I don't.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's more to it.
It really isn't procrastination. You just don't do it.
Yes.
Yeah, because procrastination implies that at some point you do.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, it took me 2 years to call in here.
Yeah. And so what are you seeing about that?
Well, what I was seeing when you were talking with the first caller is it's just a big setup for conditioning, because I want to do something, I don't do it, and then it's not an actual beating that I get, but it's more of a pressure to...
Oh, and isn't it disappointment? I mean,
yeah.
It just feels so sad. I just picture this little kid, you know, really, really, really wants to go to the beach, really, really, really wants to go swimming, and then nobody ever takes her.
Yeah. It's interesting you brought that particular thing up, because I was at your retreat in March, and that was one of the subpersonalities that was very strong, and it was this little boy that all he wanted to do was play on the beach and show me his toys. And he was the one that I determined wanted to do everything.
Uh-huh. And So do you know, have you watched, and do you know how what you want doesn't happen?
No, I really don't think I know. It just doesn't.
Okay. Then here's what I'm going to suggest, and you don't have to wait until this is finished in order to let us know what happened. But in the back of the book, Making a Change for Good, is a 30-day retreat.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole self-retreat, obviously, because it's in the back of a book. And the whole point of it is to help a person see how what happens to them happens to them, how it's done. Now, I don't think or talk in terms of how you do that, because I don't think you're doing it. You're the person who wants to do whatever this is. And somehow, in a way that you don't know yet, you get stopped. And so here's my encouragement. Start that 30-day retreat and just plug in something that you want to do that you have not been allowed to do.
Okay, yeah, because the fishy part is that, you know, I don't sit around doing nothing all day. I really do things. So something's
fishy.
It's
very specific.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's very specific. It's something that you really want to do.
Mm-hmm.
So you get to clean the house and do dishes and go to work and
yeah.
Right, pay the bills. You get to do all of that.
Yeah,
you're
exactly.
Very, very busily doing all of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. But what you don't get to do is what feeds your soul, what makes your heart light up. That's what you don't get to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so to pick one of those things that's not the biggest issue in your life, but it's not so small that somebody's going to say, oh, who cares, really? It doesn't matter.
Yeah. Okay?
And you pick that thing that you're going to do. And then you watch how you get stopped. And
okay.
Once you know how getting stopped happens, you will know how you get stopped from doing whatever it is that you want to do. Because it's the same process. It's not like you get stopped over here in this situation this way, and over there it's that. Conditioning would like us to believe that that's what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same process over and over and over with different content.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know what you're going to pick?
Yes. It's what I really, really want to do. But so the voices are like, oh, you'll never do it, or it'll be too overwhelming, or you'll never, I don't know.
Tell us, or you want to save it for next time?
I want to save it.
So you're going to let us know?
Mm-hmm.
Now, you can let us know at any point, okay? You know,
okay.
Case, all right? Because, you know, we're wildly curious here to know what happens with people.
Apparently there's someone afraid that I really won't succeed.
There's somebody more afraid that you will.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, fear, only the ego is afraid.
Mm-hmm.
Only the ego is afraid. So if we keep that in mind, then we can often see the scam. Oh, don't even try. You're not gonna be able to do that. Oh no, don't take that on. It's just gonna be too awful when you fail.
You've tried that before and you only made it halfway.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. But you know, a coach who loves you is gonna say, oh, come on. You got halfway. The rest of the way is cake. Compared to what you've already done, oh, my gosh, you're almost there. Let's go. We can do it. Yeah?
Yeah.
So we know who it is who's saying, oh, no, you're not. You're,
yes.
Don't even try. Why don't you just, you know, give up? Just quit. Quit while you're behind, as somebody said to me recently. All right. So
okay.
We'll hear from you again, huh?
Yeah, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Good night.
Good night.
Thank you for joining us. You're listening to Open Air with Sherry Huber. Sherry, we're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be right back.
Right.
Underdog Software is proud to support Open Air with Sherry Huber. For more years than we care to mention, Porchdog has been writing Windows and Mac software for customers big and small. We're pretty good at what we do, and we always try to remember that what we're doing is never more important than how we're doing it. Check us out at www.porchdogsoft.com. We look forward to hearing from you soon.
Welcome back to Open Air with Sherry Huber. Sherry, you would think if we had one caller, the total number of callers would go down by one. It has not.
Uh-huh.
So I just was going to repeat what you had said earlier, in that if people don't make it on the show tonight, we'd really love to hear from them next week.
Call early.
Call early. Great. Our next caller, you are on the air, and could you please introduce yourself?
Hi, this is Greta from Washington.
Hey, Greta.
Hi, Sherry and Michael.
How's it going?
It's going pretty well. I had a similar experience on my way home tonight to the last time I called, so I just decided to call in.
Tell us about that.
Well, I was just kind of in a fog and feeling bad, and I noticed a couple things about conditioning, and of course, it was telling me that I didn't, you know, I had nothing to say, so I shouldn't call in. So I said, okay.
Okay, I'll call.
And so, I mean, that's kind of the good news is, you know, there's been a lot of bumps in the road, but I'm starting to get it that practice is the thing that I need to do in any event.
Yes. And in all events.
Right, and so that's one of the things I just wanted to talk a little bit about because, you know, at the beginning of the year, I kind of made this commitment to myself to really take care of myself and attend more to practice. And so I downloaded all the archives. It's a really slow process at work, blah, 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 but I did it. And I've been really trying to make sure to listen to them coming and going in the car, which I get a lot of time at. And then I noticed when I wasn't listening to them for the weekend or whatever, like the first day of the weekend, I was still feeling pretty attentive and able to bring my mind and attention back. But by the third day of the weekend, I was feeling kind of vague and fuzzy and not so sharp anymore. And it just seems like all these reminders and any that we can dream up are really important things to bring us back.
They're critical. Absolutely critical.
So what I'm starting to see, you know, and part of me just really doesn't want to believe that you can practice 24 hours a day, but I'm starting to see that that's all that we can do in a way.
That's all that we can do if you really want to be alive.
Right.
And with what you're laying out, the choice is so obvious. You know, it's not like the choices are, and this is, of course, what conditioning wants us to believe. The choices are, I'm practicing all the time, and it's going to be really tedious and hard and laborious, and that's what my life is going to be. Or I could not practice and do what I want and have fun, and life will be exciting. It's just exactly the opposite. So every moment that I'm here for, life is good. It doesn't matter what I'm doing. Every moment I'm not here for is suffering. It doesn't matter what I'm doing. So
yeah, and isn't there a little bit of a trick in that, though, because when we say every moment is good, have a sense of then you get into sort of right, wrong thinking and I need to feel a certain way to be the right person. Of course, that's my thinking.
That's
but
right. Well, conditioning, now we need to remember that conditioning will use absolutely everything to argue for getting us back into that unconscious suffering place. So there I am, I'm here, and conditioning wants to say, well, yeah, but you're not feeling expansive. So maybe you're not here. I mean, you're probably not present. That's why we stress so much dropping the conversation. Because that conversation is always about suffering.
Right. And I guess sometimes it's not always clear that it's a conversation. And I said, which I had realized myself as well, you said something like, if there's more than two sentences, then you need to drop it.
Yes. Yes. Or if it starts off, well, but, or now I'm not sure, or how do you, okay, all of those kinds of conversation openers that if an external person were saying them, you inside you would be rolling your eyes going, oh, this is not going to be a good time.
Right, right. One thing I have noticed as a, this is another thing I heard you say in one of the older archives, and I'm starting to see the truth of it, which is that it doesn't matter what's going on. It really is all the same process of there's something wrong and I've got to do something about it. And
yes.
You know, if I do these things, then I'll be the right person. Everything will be okay and
yes.
Blah, blah, blah.
And it's always in the future or in the past. What you're describing is, if this changes, if you do this, if you become this person, if only this were different, if they would this, if that were, that, then I would be okay, then I would be happy. Or we could just be happy.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, I'm getting a little bit stuck in this place of, like, I feel like I can pay attention and be here, and yet I'm maybe not meeting the definition of being happy.
Well,
you know?
Being here is a doorway into the
uh-huh.
present.
Uh-huh.
It's okay. A doorway into the present. As long as, if I'm standing here going, well, you know, I'm not as happy as I thought I would be if I were in the present.
Exactly.
I'm not there yet. I'm still in a conversation.
Right, right. Well, that's the place I need to look then, because
stand in that threshold and go,
yep.
Huh.
Yep.